guys, same. There's stacks right there. You can go the same thing over there on that side. So, split up. Same thing over there, if you want to go get it over there. Okay, folks. I'd like you to find a seat. Same stuff is over there. Same thing, yeah. Okay, folks, find a seat, even if you don't have. Go find a seat, it's okay. You get the others? It's all the same thing, right? You're getting it for four people. One, two, three, four. So you're picking four of the same. Okay, folks. Sit down. Go find a seat, it's okay. Four kids. None of them went to NYU, but my youngest, when he was looking at NYU, you know how they run this tour and they take them around the buildings, and so they get on top of the in front of Tisch, and the person running the tour, I'm kind of hanging around, and the person running the tour says, below this space is the biggest classroom at NYU. But don't worry, nobody ever has to take classes in that classroom. I almost put up my hand and said, that's a lie, because this is the only room I've been teaching in for 20 years now. Okay? When I get a room of 100, it feels so intimate. This place has the ambiance of Madison Square Garden, which is not a compliment. Okay? It's a horrible classroom. It's a horrible classroom because architects, when they design classrooms, think of acoustics one way. You will be able to hear me because I have a mic. God help me. If my mic fails, we're done. Right? So that's one thing. We've lost power before in this classroom. Say, okay, we're done. The problem is when you talk, others will not be able to hear you because the acoustics were never designed for people actually asking questions. This is what happens when people who've never, architects must have been in classes at some point in time and asked questions, but they seem to have forgotten that. This is a long lead into saying when you have questions in this class, and for the first few weeks, you will be intimidated. You know why? Everybody is here. You don't want them to know that you don't know. By the fifth week, you're going to be loose as a goose. You're going to be asking questions. I have to remember to take your questions and say them. So remind me if I forget, because otherwise we're going to have one-way Q&As. Okay? So let me get started. I came to NYU in 1986, okay? September of 1986. When I came to NYU, they gave me a class to teach. It was a class called Security Analysis. And for those of you who've never heard of this class, this is a class with a long and hoary tradition. It was taught by a guy called Ben Graham at Columbia University in the 1950s. The guy must not have been a very good teacher, to be quite honest. He had only 5 students. The great thing about teaching is you're always blessed by your students, and Ben Graham's most famous student was, come on, you know him, Warren Buffett. So it's a legendary class. They gave it to me to teach in 1986. I took one look at the class and said, I'm not teaching this class, the most boring class ever. Not a great attitude for an assistant professor to take right after you've been hired. But the head of the department was a good guy. He said, what would you like to teach instead? And first he said, what's so boring about the class? And by 1986, it was showing its age. It was 4 weeks on stocks, and 3 weeks on bonds, and 2 weeks on futures and options, and 5 weeks in institutional detail. Like what? There was an entire session on listing requirements for the New York Stock Exchange. Teaching was so easy in the days before Wikipedia. You could actually come in and list the dozen listing requirements. People took everything down. They thought you were a genius, and they walked out. Today, if I tried that, you'd be checking Wikipedia while I was doing it, saying, I can see it right here. So I went to the head of the department and said, I don't want to teach this class. He said, what would you like to teach instead? I said, I'd like to teach a class on valuation. He said, don't do it. Nobody teaches valuation. There isn't enough stuff in valuation to fill a class. And he was right. In 1986, there wasn't enough stuff in valuation. There were no books on valuation. There were no classes on valuation. But I really, really, really wanted to teach this class. And I learned very early in my academic life that the best way to get things done at a university is to do them subversively. Because if you try to get official permission, you know what would happen? A committee would be formed. You know what happens when committees form? They meet and they meet and they meet. They forget what they're meeting about. They're baby committees that they call subcommittees. It gets very incestuous. 35 years later, they'd have come back to me and said, oh, you can teach the class. But by then, I'd have been too old to teach the class. So I said, I'll teach a security analysis class. And I walked in and taught a valuation class. They have no idea what I do in a classroom. Remember in 1986, there were no cameras in the classroom. I closed the door. I could teach cooking for 15 weeks, and nobody would catch on. As long as I gave everybody A's, nobody's going to complain. You know how long it took them to catch on? In 2008, I get a call from the dean's office. 2008. So we hear you're teaching a valuation class. I said, yes, I've been doing it for 22 years. They said, we don't see it anywhere in the course schedule. It's not listed. I said, that's easy to explain. I've been hijacking all these other classes you've been giving me and teaching valuation instead. For 12 years, I taught a class called Equity Instruments and Markets. I am not in the least bit interested in markets or instruments or even equity, which you take those three words out, what are you left with? And? I might as well teach valuation. Last spring, when I taught this class, incidentally, I'm teaching this class to you and to the MBAs. It is exactly the same class. Don't ask me, you know, aren't we undergraduates? Shouldn't be dumb. No, 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 it should be dumbed down for the MBAs. They're too lazy to put in the work. It's exactly the same class. So if you miss a class, you can sit in on the MBA class as well. It's in the same room, same ambiance. I don't even know who's coming and who's going within this room. Okay? It was my 55th semester teaching this class. And I'm going to say something about this class that's going to encapsulate how I think about valuation and hopefully can bring through in the next 15 weeks. Everything I know about valuation, I've learned in the course of teaching this class. Notice how I phrased it. The first time I taught this class in 1986, my syllabus ran 4 weeks. It's a 15-week class. People came and said, how come it runs only 4 weeks? I said, that's all I can think of right now. They said, what happens after week four? I said, we'll find out. Maybe we'll have 11 weeks of cooking instead. But think of how much has changed even in my limited lifetime teaching this class. In 1987, I was teaching this class. I taught it downtown because the business school building was downtown for the MBAs. Right next to the American Stock Exchange. October 19th of 1987. I remember coming back into my office, looking out of my window. And everybody from the stock exchange was on the street. So what happened? A fire alarm went off? It was a one-day crash. That day, the S&P 500 dropped 22% in 1 day. Think about it. Think about what a 22% drop would look like for U.S. equity markets today. That would be a 5,000-point drop in the Dow. 22% drop in 1 day. Had a valuation class the next day, and guess what people wanted to talk about? They wanted to talk about how do you explain a 22% drop in stock prices in 1 day? Then you got to the 1990s, and you saw the rise of the online commerce business, Amazon, PayPal, eBay. And guess what we had to talk about in class? We had to talk about how, if at all, can you explain why Amazon.com at that time was worth $10 billion or $15 billion. Then you got to the last decade, 2000 to 2009. Initially, we had interest rates doing strange things. And then you had the 2008 crisis right in the middle of this class. And guess what we had to talk about? How can value change that much? Where do we draw the line between developed and emerging markets? And then you got to the last decade, and we had to talk about social media companies and how their values could go up even though their revenues and cash flows and earnings might not be that good. I wasn't teaching this class in the fall. But if I'd been teaching in September, guess what I'd have been valuing in class? I'd have been valuing WeWork and Uber and Lyft. And guess what we'll be valuing in this class? Maybe we'll do Casper next week. And Airbnb is probably going to go public sometime in these 15 weeks. It's going to be interesting. It always is. There's always something interesting going on in valuation. So every one of these classes, I'm going to start with doing something very strange. I'm going to do a quiz of what we're going to cover in the class. Sounds ass backwards, right? So you're supposed to do the class and then do a quiz. I'll give you a post-class quiz, but we'll do a pre-class quiz. And the reason I want to do that is there's nothing in valuation that is so complex and complicated that you can't figure it out yourselves. There's nothing better than being, I figure that out on my own. So we're going to start every class with a quiz, and this class is no exception. So there is no right answer. Don't look at your neighbors. Just think about what comes instinctively to mind on these three questions, and then we launch into what this class is about. So this is that single page. Don't worry if you don't have the page. Incidentally, today's the last day. I'm going to bring physical handouts down to the class, and you can see why. This is going to be like a bazaar if I brought in physical handouts. After this, everything will be PDFs and downloads and online. So if you have an iPad, you don't even have to print it. Save those rainforests in Brazil if you need to. Now, download it, bring it in on an iPad. So everything after this will be online. So the start of the class test will be online as well, starting with this next class. So you ready? First question. I'm not going to answer it right now. I will answer it in a few minutes. But right now, based upon your priors, whatever you think this class is about, whatever you think valuation is about, do you think valuation is a science? Do you think it's an art? Do you think it's magic? Or maybe it's none of the above, in which case, write what you think best describes valuation as a discipline. It's a science, it's an art, it's magic, whatever else. Ready? Second question. We're going to value companies. We're going to value businesses. We're going to value all kinds of things in this class. Okay? So So I'm going to start with a very simple question. What kinds of companies do you think are easiest to value? And I'll give you some choices. When a company is mature in money-making and the economy is stable, when the company is mature in money-making, the economy is in crisis, when a company is young and in transition, the economy is stable, and then you get the trifecta. A company is young or in transition, and the economy is in crisis. When is valuation simplest? It's not a trick question. You're saying, I've never done valuation before. You don't have to have done valuation. Just think about which of these four groups of companies is going to be easiest to value. Okay? Now, I have a follow-up question. Now that you've told me which one's easiest to value, I want you to tell me in which of these four groups is valuation going to have the biggest payoff to you as an investor? You're saying, isn't the answer going to be the same? I want you to think about it. Whether the companies that are easiest to value are the ones where there's actually a payoff to doing valuation. Because we're going to value across the spectrum, young companies, old companies, emerging market, developed market. Yes? You can put, can you have more than one scenario? Yes, if you can reason through your answer. As I said, there's no right answer. If you can see more than one that fits, go ahead and pick two. No. And final question. And this is really about you. So don't even look at your neighbor. There is absolutely no right answer. You've heard the legend of the left brain and the right brain? Left brain. I've heard it's total fiction, but it's such good fiction, we might as well act like it's fact. The left brain presumably controls logic. The right brain controls your creative instincts. The left brain is numbers. The right brain is stories. I want you to think about the answer to this question. If I asked you to describe yourself as a person, would you describe yourself as a numbers person or a story person? I'm going to come back and explain why the answer to this question matters. Are you a numbers person or a story person? Again, if you want to cheat and say, I'm a numbers and story person, a story, tell me which one comes first. Okay? You can be both, but one of them dominates. Tell me which one dominates. Okay? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with the, it's really not quite a syllabus. I don't, And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I call the philosophical foundations of valuation in the course of talking about the syllabus. So let me give you some administrative stuff, get it out of the way. Okay? My office, I should have been specific, is in KMAC, 969. So it's in the MBA school, it's the other building. Okay? My email address is right there, my homepage, and I'll talk a little bit about what you will find on my homepage. My office hours are going to be structured around my three classes. Because I teach three classes on Monday and Wednesday, I'm going to have my office hours structured on those days. Okay? But I'm going to say something very strange. If you have an involved question to answer, don't try to find me during my office hours. I have what I call the fair game principle. If you've never heard it, here's how it goes. If you find me, I'm fair game. Which means my job for the next 15 weeks is to make sure you don't find me. So I take the stairs every day because I know you guys are so lazy that you take the elevator. So if you want to find me, take the stairs. You catch me on the fifth floor. You know. In fact, to show you how people stretch the fair game, there was a time when we had the Kohl Center as the gym for NYU. It's now knocked down. I don't even know what's going on there. I think they're building a mafia castle or something. Yeah. But I used to go to the gym in the middle of my Mondays and Wednesdays, and I noticed this person from one of my classes, was an MBA corporate finance class, would keep showing up at the same time that I was on the treadmill, on the next treadmill, and while I was on the treadmill, he would keep asking me questions. So I'm going to introduce a new rule. If my pulse rate exceeds 100, I will not be held responsible for any answers that I give you. So you might want to bring something to check out. No, is he breathing too hard? Maybe I shouldn't ask him the questions now. You have two TAs for this class. Courtney and Sam both took the class last semester. The reason I picked them is they sat in the same seats. Actually, I think they took ownership of the seats for the 15 weeks. Okay? And they, not only did they do well in the class, they kind of immersed themselves in the class. They will be the TFs on this class. They will run a session every week where they will actually go through problems from past quizzes, because I will not work through problems in class. It's a waste of your time and a waste of my time for me to sit with an Excel spreadsheet and take you through line item by line item. But they will take you through the problems and answers from previous quizzes. So I'll give you the details of when their office hours are, when their sessions will be, and I'll create a Google Shared spreadsheet for you to sign up, because their sessions will not be in this room. This room is prized territory for the university. They will not. So the room they will use is about 60 people. So once you get to 60, it'll stop. Most of the time, you have 15, 20 people in these sessions, but the Google Shared spreadsheet will allow you to sign up. So let's start with the first question. I remember I asked you, is it a valuation of science or not? Let's first look at the question, is valuation a science? Let me make it easier. Is mathematics a science? It's not a trick question. Is mathematics a science? It is the only pure science. In fact, mathematicians are convinced that the rest of us are imposters. So let me ask you a follow-up question. What is it about mathematics that makes it a science? Anybody want to try? What is it about mathematics that makes it a science? It's not empirical. What does that I don't even know what that means.
It means that the knowledge that you build in math, it's given by definition rather than by exploration.
It's absolutes. What's 2 plus 3? Not a trick question. Let's do this right off the top, because if you're taking a valuation class and you have trouble with 2 plus 3, maybe we should re-examine. Strategy classes might be better for you, because it doesn't matter what 2 plus 3 is. What's 2 plus 3? 5, right? I can count on my left hand, my right hand, my toes. I can use a calculator, a computer, North Pole, South Pole. 2 plus 3 is always 5. Not maybe 5, could be 5, might be 5. It is 5. The essence of a science, if you get the inputs right, you get the output right. And if you got the output wrong, you must have done something wrong. Physics is mostly a science. The laws of gravity are the laws of gravity. We all went up to the 9th floor of this building, and we all jumped off. We don't fall in the order of our IQs or our GPAs. The laws of gravity are absolute. Physics is mostly a science. But the essence of a science is you get the inputs right, you're going to get the output right. Is there any chance that valuation can be a science? What am I asking you? I sit down to value Caspers. I take advantage of all the data that's out there, all the tools, all the models. I value Casper, making my best estimates for the future. Is there even a remote chance that I will get the value exactly right? There's a zero chance. Valuation can never be a science. The sooner we come to that recognition, the healthier the discussion becomes about valuation. Valuation is definitely not a science. This is the mistake that accountants make. I'm going to say terrible things about accountants and even more worse things about bankers. The mistake that accountants make is they think they can make valuation a science by writing more rules. Fair value accounting is a charade. It's an oxymoron. But accounting has adopted it full scale. They think they can make it a science if they have enough rules. Valuation can never be a science. So it must be an art, right? So let's take that apart. Is painting an art? Not painting your house. You know the paintings I'm talking about, the ones that hang in the mat. Absolutely, right? It's an art. In fact, I remember taking my oldest son. He's now 30 years old. When he was 8 years old, to a Picasso exhibit at the Met. So we lasted about 30 minutes, which is how long an 8-year-old lasts in a museum. We would come out and say, hey, Ryan, what do you think about that exhibit? He said, Dad, I was not impressed. I said, what's a Picasso exhibit? He said, this guy can't get the nose in the right place. If you notice this about Picasso, his nose comes out of the side of the head, the top of the head, the bottom of the cheek. It's almost like he was either drugged or drunk, which given Picasso's history, was probably both. But for whatever reason, we've gathered together, and Picasso is a genius. The essence of an art is you really cannot teach it. Thank God valuation is not an art. I wasted 32 years of my life trying to teach something that cannot be taught. So if it's not a science and it's not an art, what the heck is it? I'll give you the word that I would use to describe valuation. It's a craft. In fact, cooking is a really good analogy to use here. How do you master cooking? You could do what my daughter does. She watches the Food Network like it's going out of style. Chopped episode after Chopped. She can't cook a lick, but she can tell you in theory how to make a souffle. She's seen it on TV multiple times. You don't learn cooking by watching TV. You don't learn cooking by reading cookbooks. You learn cooking by cooking. And the first time you cook, what happens? Fire alarms go off. And you'll probably have to eat out. I remember the first time I scrambled eggs. Nobody told me I was supposed to spray the damn pan. I finished scrambling. They look really good, but they won't come off the pan. Pan and eggs went in the trash, but I learned a very important lesson about scrambling eggs. You learn cooking by doing. You learn valuation by doing, which is really incredibly bad news. You know why? For the next 15 weeks, you're going to watch me talk about valuation. You're not going to learn valuation by watching me talk about valuation. You're not going to learn valuation by reading books on valuation. I can give you plenty of reading. You will learn valuation by actually valuing companies. And I'm going to make you do it even if you don't want to, because that's the only way to learn valuation. And if you truly want to learn valuation, you have to value lots of different companies. If all you cook is scrambled eggs day after day after day, you're going to get really good at scrambling eggs. But if I ask you to make a stir fry, you're sunk. If all you can do is value nice, healthy consumer product companies, and I come to you with Casper, you're saying, what the heck do I do with this? So I'm going to make you get uncomfortable, because when you look at these companies that are different, difficult to value, so I don't want to do that. But I'm going to at least I'm going to give you a chance to learn valuation by trying to value different kinds of companies. So remember that. The essence of a craft, though, is you never quite master it. I have to remind myself of that. After 33 years of teaching and doing valuation, there's lots about valuation I don't know. So I'll talk about what I've learned in the process of doing valuation. I didn't know that. 3 months ago, I valued Aramco, another company that would have been on our to-do list if we'd had a fall valuation class. And maybe we'll talk about Aramco. So somebody tell me, what does Aramco do? It is, if you were thinking about a politically incorrect investment, Aramco would be that investment in spades, right? It's fossil fuels, run by a feudal, basically you want to piss off all of your liberal friends, just buy Aramco and announce it at a party, I own Aramco, nobody will ever talk to you again. But it's actually, at one level, a very easy company to value. Why? Where does it get its value from? It has 330 billion barrels of oil under the Saudi sands. How did it get that oil? It was endowed. So if you think about it, it must be great management that found the oil. No, you were the Saudi oil company. The Saudi royal family said, here, oil is all yours. 330 billion barrels. And it's not just that they have one of the largest reserves in the world. In Saudi Arabia, you stick your finger in the sand, oil comes out. In Canada, you've got to dig 5,000 feet under the ground, unfreeze the oil, refreeze it, God only knows what. Their value comes from the fact that they have an insane amount of oil that they can extract at a cost, about half what it costs other oil companies. So it's easy to value, until it wasn't. What's your biggest risk when you invest in Aramco? You can say oil prices go up and down, but you know what? If oil prices go to $30 a barrel, the only company in the world that can actually produce oil at a profit then will be Aramco. In a strange way, it'll make them the monopoly. When you invest in Aramco, it's not that you're worried about, hey, oil price could drop so low that the oil's going to be worth nothing. He's saying, what if people stop using oil? These people drive in SUVs to tell you that they're going to stop using oil. It's not going to, they have about 50 years of reserves. I can almost guarantee you there's enough demand out there for people to buy the oil for the next 50 years. So So what worries you? Aramco is not just a company. It's a country. 80% of Saudi Arabia's GDP comes from oil, and Aramco controls. So you're investing not just in a company, you're investing in a country. And you're not just investing in a country, you're investing in the Saudi royal family, because in a sense, they're all connected at the hip. You see where I ran into my troubles in valuation? The risk here is not the kinds of risk you worry about when you value Royal Dutch, where you say oil prices go up and down. Here, the risk is a risk of discontinuous change. And I'm going to leave it at that. Discontinuous change is the kind of change you hear about in Egypt in 2009 or Libya in 2008. Something could happen that could cause the whole system to implode, and there goes your entire investment down the drain. I had to grapple with that when I valued Aramco, and I'd never had to do it on that scale before. And I learned something about political risk. So what I'm going to encourage you to do is you think about valuation of the graph. This is the start of the process. At the end of 15 weeks, even if you get an A-plus on this class, your job is not done. In fact, it's just beginning. If you truly want to understand valuation, you've got to keep the door open saying there's so much more for me to learn. So valuation is a craft. We're going to talk, and whenever I get a chance, I'm going to talk about the craft aspect. So whenever I value a company, I'm going to say, this is what I learned on this particular valuation that helped me on other ones. Because that's what you're looking for, learning that you can carry into other valuations. Second, what's this class going to cover? Most of you probably thought we're going to value just publicly traded companies. And guess what? We're going to spend a lot of time valuing publicly traded companies. You know why? Because the information is there. It's easy to get. But the process we're going to develop is going to apply to private businesses as well. So if your family owns a business, you need to value the business. In fact, your need to value that business might be greater than my need to value Aramco. We're going to value young companies and old companies. We're going to value companies across the life cycle. And that's something I'm going to introduce in this class and talk about, is I believe just like human beings, companies go through a life cycle. Startups are like babies. That's why it's so difficult. Say, what will that start? That's like looking at a baby. Say, what will that baby be doing at the age of 35? Then you get a little older. You're a toddler. What do toddlers do? They fall all the time. And young startups often fall. And then you get into your teenage years. Many of you, that wasn't that far in the past. Remember your teenage years? What did you do every day? You woke up and said, what can I do today to screw it all up? Teenagers can be described as having lots of potential and figuring out really creative ways of screwing it all up by doing something really stupid. When I bought Tesla in June of last year, the luckiest investment of my life at 180, I described it as my corporate teenager. You know why? Tesla has lots of potential, but what's your problem? A guy called Elon Musk keeps trying to screw it all up by sending out tweets about Thai divers and boring under the ground and God only knows what. And I said, if only he shuts up, I'm going to make money. And thank God he shut up for 7 months. And the stock is at 560. I'm hoping he learns from this. But that might be hoping for too much. We're going to value young companies. We're going to value corporate teenagers. We're going to value mature companies. And then we're going to value what I call the truly depressing end of valuation, beyond mature companies, old companies, walking dead companies, zombie companies. Let's face it. Where do you think GE is in the life cycle? Staggering towards a grave? Is it fun to value GE? Not at all. But guess what? You have to value the GEs and the Teslas, the GMs and Fords and the Teslas. So we'll talk about companies across the life cycle. We'll talk about private companies, public companies. We'll talk about emerging market. I'm not going to have an emerging market valuation session because it's silly. Valuation is valuation. It has to apply across the board. And do you really think Apple is a U.S. company? It's incorporated in the U.S. It's a global company that through the accident of history happens to be incorporated in the U.S. But it gets 43% of its revenues outside the U.S. So we're going to talk about valuing all kinds of public companies. We're going to talk about valuing private companies. We're going to talk about valuing companies from the perspective of investors, which is often what we think about in valuation. Those investors can be private equity investors, acquirers, individual investors, but we're also going to talk about valuing companies from the inside. Saying, why would companies need to be valued from the inside? You're the manager at Procter & Gamble. What's your job? To increase the value of the company. How are you going to do that if you don't understand what drives the value of the company? So whether you're going to be a consultant, a banker, a CFO, an entrepreneur, there's something in this class that you need because valuation is one of those tools that everybody needs. Third, I'm going to draw a distinction between two words that we use interchangeably, and we should not. Value and price. Let me explain the difference. We know what drives value. We've always known it. We've known it for hundreds of years. The value of a business or asset is driven by three things. It's cash flows, the growth in those cash flows, and the risk in those cash flows. Cash flows, growth, and risk. It's always been true. Whether you use a discounted cash flow model is a mechanical detail, but we know the value of a business is driven by cash flows, growth, and risk. So when you use a discounted cash flow valuation, as we will, we're trying to value Aramco. We're trying to value Tesla. You know what drives price? Demand and supply. What drives demand and supply? God only knows. It could be fundamentals like cash flows, growth, and risk, but it could also be mood. It could be momentum. Look how quickly the market turned on Friday because of coronavirus. Mood can shift in a moment. Price reflects demand and supply. Now you're saying, but shouldn't the two be equal? If you believe in efficient markets, value and price should converge. But if you believe in efficient markets, what the heck are you doing in this class? Because in an inefficient market, what's Tesla's right value? Go open the newspaper or go online, check out the market price. It is going to be the best estimate of value. The very fact that you're sitting there means that you think that sometimes markets make mistakes, that price and value can diverge. But the tools you need to price something are very different than the tools you need to value something. I'll give you a little bit of insight. Most of you are too young to own apartments or houses, but maybe you got a wealthy parent who said, oh, here's a couple of million, go buy an apartment in New York City. Let's say you get that couple of million tonight. You go shopping for an apartment tomorrow. You're going to have to hire a realtor still in New York, right? The realtor shows you an apartment, no, somewhere, East Village, for 2 million, that's about what you can get, and says, this apartment is worth 1.5 million. How did the realtor come up the number for that apartment? Did she do a discounted cash flow valuation of the apartment? I don't think so. What did she do or he do? Looked at other apartments in the neighborhood that had sold and said, this apartment has one extra bedroom and a bigger deck, therefore it's worth 1.5 million. That's pricing. Why is it pricing? Because you're looking at where other people pay for similar assets and you're saying, hey, this is similar. It's like being on StubHub looking for a seat. I was going to say a Knicks game, but they're actually paying people to go to the game. You say, you want to go to Knicks game? I'll pay you $25 to take my season ticket. But somebody that you actually want to watch. How do you check out? You go to StubHub, you look to see what seats are selling for in a section. That is pricing. You're saying, that's so unsophisticated. You ever seen an equity research report? First, it's works of fiction, nothing to do with valuation. They say, this stock is cheap. And how do they make that judgment? They give you a P/E ratio for the stock. They show you 15 other stocks. And those stocks are just like this stock. Therefore, the stock is cheap. That's a pricing judgment. Who do you think is on more solid ground? The realtor, when he or she put a number on your apartment, or an equity research analyst is pricing Microsoft, and claims to have found 15 other companies just like Microsoft. I think the realtors are much more solid ground. 90% of what passes for valuation out there is out there in your interviews, in investment banks, in equity. It's not valuation, it's pricing. There's nothing wrong with it. They have a job to do. They have to price things. My advice to them is stop the charade of doing discounted cash flow valuations. I know your heart's not in it. Just price the damn thing and be honest about it. We can talk about whether the pricing makes sense. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to spend a big chunk of this class talking about intrinsic valuation, because that's where my heart lies. Cash flows, growth, and risk, discount. But then I'm going to spend a fairly hefty amount of time talking about how to price things. Because I think the problem in pricing is not that you cannot do it, but people are so incredibly sloppy in terms of throwing away data and using statistics that we can do a much better job of pricing. But from this class on, for the next 15 weeks, when I want to talk about valuing something, I'm going to say the word value. And when I talk about pricing something, I'm going to try to use the word price. And if I slip up, point it out to me. Value versus price. Now let's turn to that question. Are you a storyteller or a number cruncher? You're saying, how would I know? Hey, you've known for a really long time. I'll tell you when I knew. I knew when I was maybe 12, 13, after my first English literature class. I was asked to read Moby Dick, and I did. I was a good kid. I came ready for a discussion of whales and captains. And about 20 minutes into the discussion, I noticed that nobody was talking about the whale. So I put up my hand and said, when are we going to talk about the whale? I've done all this research on whales. And I remember the instructor saying, there is no whale. I said, what? I distinctly remember a big fish going all the way through this book. Now you tell me there's no fish? She said, it's a metaphor. My jaw dropped. And the rest of this class was about hidden meanings in things that I didn't even know had a meaning in the first place. And I remember coming out of that class with a singular conclusion. I said, never again am I going to subject myself to that kind of bullshit. And the rest of my high school life was laid out for me. I avoided the literature classes like the plague. It was Algebra 1, Algebra 2, Algebra 3 out of high school. And these were the good old days. Notice from the good old days? You went to colleges and they had no core curriculum. You know what I'm talking about, the core curriculum? All these crappy classes they say you have to take, and you ask them why, and they say, to get a rounded education. They're lying. It's to keep the history department employed. Because without it, I'm going to hear it. But in those days, you could take numbers class, numbers degree, accounting, engineering, and then you got a numbers job. And some of you, many of you, in fact, there's a selection bias here. My guess is you are numbers people looking for a numbers job. And I'll predict what's going to happen about 5 years after you graduate. You're going to get incredibly bored at your job. Because when I ask this question in my MBA class next week, there were going to be about 300 people in that class as well. About 200 are going to be numbers people who got numbers job, bankers, recovering accountants, recovering engineers. They're back because they couldn't take the number crunching anymore. You're saying, what's wrong with being a number cruncher? There's nothing wrong, but number crunchers have their own sets of delusions. As a number cruncher, let me lay out some of the delusions I have, and you tell me whether you share them. The first is the delusion of precision. You know what number crunchers do when they're in doubt? They add decimals. It makes them feel so much more comfortable. Look, I have 5 decimal points here. It must be precise. The delusion of precision. The second is the delusion of being in control. If you put a number on something, you control it. Just because you measured risk, you think you're in control of risk. And the third is you have the delusion of being objective. Look, I'm just using numbers. And if you hang out with other number crunchers and that's all you do, guess what? These don't operate like delusions anymore. This is the way you think everybody thinks. So next week when I ask this, 200 of my MBAs are going to say we're number crunchers. How many people in this class are more naturally number crunchers? Really, that few. Our admissions process must be slipping. We used to just get number crunches, but you can see, class. How many of you are more naturally storytellers? I'll describe what storytellers look like, and you tell me whether you fall into this group. Take you back to my literature class. Storytellers love this hidden meaning stuff. They lap it up. They're the poets. They're like my youngest son. He writes poetry. He showed me his first poem. I don't think he's going to show me anymore. He said, Dad, what do you think? And I said, Kieran, this is all very impressive, but aren't the last words supposed to rhyme? That's what I think about poetry. Nursery rhymes, I got stuck there. And I remember the look of contempt he gave me. He said, Dad, you're not a poet. And I said, Kiran, you're right. I'm not a poet. They take literature one, literature two, literature three, graduate, go on to become history majors at Yale. And then they graduate and they discover that even Yale history majors don't get paid very much. So after about 4 or 5 years of poverty-stricken wages as journalists or writers, they quit and they come back to business school. They'll be in my class as well. So I'll have 200 number crunchers and 100 storytellers in my MBA class. How many of you are storytellers here? And you have your own sets of delusions, right? You like being creative. You don't like those numbers, people. They get in the way of you being creative. You have a monopoly, in fact, on telling stories. And you think the bigger the story, the bigger the number I should give you. And you love anecdotal evidence. And if you hang out with other storytellers, that's all you hear is, right? Anecdote after anecdote. Now, this is a valuation class, right? So who do you think has the upper hand? You'd think the number crunchers would. It's a numbers class. So I'm going to let you in what I think is the biggest hidden secret in valuation. A good valuation is never just about numbers. A good valuation is never just a story. A good valuation is a bridge between stories and numbers. Sounds fancy, right? What do you mean? If I showed you an Excel spreadsheet of the valuation, you point to my revenues in year 10 and say, why are your revenues for Casper $4 billion in year 10? You know the answer you don't want to hear is? It's because I used a 40% growth rate for the first 5 years and 20% thereafter. It tells you absolutely nothing. I need to tell you a story about the company and the mattresses itself that will allow them to have $4 billion in revenues. Every number in your valuation has to have a story attached to it, and every story you tell me about a company, its great brand name, its amazing management, has to have a number that goes with it. I told you the biggest hidden secret in valuation. It was so hidden I didn't know it the first 5 years I taught this class. The first 5 years I taught this class, as a number cruncher did. When in doubt, I put up an equation. If I was still doubtful, I put up a second equation. If I was still queasy, I made them simultaneous equations and solved for it. It did absolutely nothing, but it made me feel good. But I realized pretty early in this process that if all I had were numbers in a spreadsheet, I could never act on that valuation. I had to teach myself storytelling. And the first time I tried to do it was like the first time I scrambled eggs. It didn't go well. But here's the good news. The more you do it, the easier it gets. Today, when I sit down to value a company, I always think of the story first. So one of the things I'm going to do during the course of this class is I'm going to take you through the sequence I use to connect stories, numbers. And I have to be disciplined, because if I'm not, I'm going to open up a spreadsheet and start entering numbers. Here's my vision for a successful valuation class. By the end of this class, those of you who are number crunchers, I hope you're willing to trust your imagination enough to be imaginative number crunchers. And those of you who are storytellers, I hope you get comfortable enough with the numbers that you become disciplined storytellers. If you ask me what makes for somebody good at valuation, you're either a disciplined storyteller or an imaginative number cruncher. Work on your weak side, because as you sit down to value companies, your strong side will call to you. Open a spreadsheet if you're a number cruncher. Let's enter the numbers. Let's look for equations. Pause and try to work on your weak side, because that's what's going to make you good at valuing companies. Finally, I don't do valuation because I'm interested in theory. In fact, often I value companies on my blog. That sounds very 21st century. I get a lot of pushback from people who don't like my valuation, whether it's valuing Tesla or valuing Casper or valuing WeWork, and they accuse me of being a theorist. And I have to laugh, because I know how little theory there is in this class. In fact, I'm going to show you all of the theory in this class on one page next session. It's one equation. There's no theory here. Valuation is an exercise in being pragmatic. which means I'm going to bend rules to try to, my end game is I have to value things. I'm going to get there by hook or by crook, and I'm going to try to make as many assumptions as I need to make to get there. I'm not going to let uncertainty stop me, because uncertainty is not just for me. Everybody's uncertain. You've got to deal with it, make your best estimates. And ultimately, I do valuation because I want to act on my valuations. I didn't value Tesla because I was intellectually curious. I don't lie awake and say, I wonder what Tesla is worth right now. Maybe you do, but I'd suggest seeing a psychologist if you have that problem, or a psychiatrist or whatever. You're seriously sick. I value Tesla because I wanted to act on my valuation. You know what I mean by act? I come up with a value higher than the price. What should I be willing to do? I need to be willing to buy. But action is actually much more difficult. In the abstract, you're all saying, I'm going to act. At the end of this semester, you're going to value a company. You're going to come up with a number, and I'm going to ask you, are you willing to act? And you're going to see how difficult it is to pull the trigger, because you need faith. Faith in what? First, faith that the valuation you've done has actually delivered a value that you have faith in. And second, for you to make money, what has to happen? The price has to move towards value. Faith that markets will correct. Notice the word I used, faith. Because during the course of this class, some of you can say, can you prove to me that if I value companies, I'm going to make money? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say, hey, why don't you go to church and ask the priest, hey, prove to me that God exists, and then I will pray. The essence of faith is I cannot prove it, which means that I could be completely wrong, that this could be delusional. In fact, I tell people, my test on whether people should be investing based on valuation is, run this experiment. It's a very depressing experiment. Assume you get to be 85, 86. You're on your deathbed. And I am your ex-friend. I used to be a friend, but after my conversation with you on your deathbed, I'm no longer going to be a friend. Here's what I've done. I've taken you 60 years of stock performance on your portfolio, where you pick stocks carefully based on evaluations, and I've compared it what you'd have made investing in index funds over that same period. And I've come to you with some bad news. I said, look, over the last 60 years, you've done all these DCFs, you've done all this research, but you actually made 1% less than what you'd have made if you just put your money in the S&P 500 index fund. Here's my question for you. Are you going to be okay with that? And if your answer is no, I tell people, don't try to be an active investor. This is not a game where there are guarantees. And if you measure success by, did I make money, you're going to get frustrated, then you're going to get angry, and then you're going to do stupid things to show the market who's boss. I've seen it happen over and over. And it never ends well. You know what? I believe I have faith in valuation, but the essence of faith is it's always going to get tested. You know how it's going to get tested? You value a stock at 50, the stock's trading at 40, you go buy the stock. Good, you have faith. Next day, the stock goes to 35. What is the market doing? Knocking on your door. Do you still have faith? Shaking inside your house. Yes, yes, yes. Next day, the stock goes to 30. Market comes back and knocks on your door. Do you still have faith? By the time it gets to 27, you've sold the stocks. I have no more faith. Faith is not something that I can give to you. It's got to come from within. I can give you the tools to do valuation. You can start investing. But faith has to come from within, and for some of you, it'll never come, and that's okay. You can live perfectly happy lives without ever making money on discounted cash flow valuations. So it's fine. But that's something that I want you to start thinking about. It's not going to come over the course of the 15 weeks. It's a process. And the essence of faith, as I said, is you have to be willing. If your faith is absolute, it's not faith. It's dogma. I've been invited to go to Omaha for the 7th or 8th time. This, you know what happens in Omaha every year? It's called Investing Woodstock, where two geriatric old men get up on a stage and chat with each other, and thousands of people come from all over the world to listen to them talk, Berkshire Hathaway meetings. And I should tell you, the crowd there terrifies me because it's full of people who have dogma. They're convinced that they have the answer already. To me, that's not really what investing is about. Investing is about having questions, being doubtful, and being willing to let those doubts play out. So a little bit of structure for the class. This is for the first two sessions. You've got the slides that I gave out the introduction. So we're going to talk about that, you know, for the first two sessions, kind of lay the table for what's coming. Then we're going to spend about 10 sessions checking to see how much you remember from your foundations. What's your corporate finance class called at the undergraduate level? For some reason, it's called corporate finance. I think they did that because the first time they asked me to teach it, it's called financial management or something. I just called it corporate finance. I said, this is stupid. It's corporate finance. Why do you keep renaming things? So this class is called equity valuation. Get rid of the equity. It's valuation. So I will never use the word equity because it's really not about valuing equity. It's about valuing businesses, valuing just about anything. Okay? But I'm going to test you on the basics of cash flows and discount rates and growth rates. Do you really know what a risk-free rate is? Or how to measure relative risk? Or what a cost of capital is? You say, oh, yes, so those are all... You'd be amazed at how many levels of detail there are in each of these inputs that could get you into trouble. So we're going to spend about 10 sessions where we're going to immerse ourselves in the details, risk-free rates, risk premiums, cost of capital, cash flows, growth rates, terminal value. And during those 10 sessions, you're going to get impatient because I'm not going to value a single company all the way through. I'm going to take a company, compute its cost of capital, let it go. And then I'm going to hit you with three sessions, evaluation after evaluation, where I'm going to range the spectrum from WeWork to GE. We're going to talk about valuing companies across the spectrum, emerging, developed. So sessions 13 through 16 are basically just valuation after valuation after valuation. Sessions 17 through 20, I'm going to talk about pricing, PE ratios, price to book, EV to EBITDA, all this magical stuff that gets thrown at you. How to price companies right, how to price businesses right. In session 20, we're going to spend time talking about what's called asset-based valuation, which is valuing pieces of a company. Some of the parts valuation. A company like GE, you can value each part of the company separately, add them all up. We'll talk about what's different about it, why it might be difficult, when it might make sense. Session 21, we'll talk about private company valuation. And you're going to see why only one session? Because you've laid the foundations in session 3 to 12. You're going to very quickly see that that foundation travels really well. Sessions 22 through 25, we're going to talk about the only part of valuation where there's something new and different. Where we've taken things we've learned in option pricing and we apply them in valuation. It's called real option valuation. Companies which you might not be able to otherwise value, you're going to be able to value using an option pricing approach. A young biotech company. What's different about it? It's got a single product working its way through the pipeline. It has no revenues, no earnings. You think, what's options got to do with it? Options are contingent cash flows. If something happens, the cash flows kick in. And with a young biotech company, what's that something? You have to get FDA approval for that product to make sense. You could spend billions in a biotech company and have nothing to show for it. We're going to talk about special places in valuation where you can apply option pricing, real options. Session 26, we're going to do acquisition valuation. You see, only one session. Nothing that unique about valuing a target company. The two words that you see thrown in acquisitions are control and synergy. And the cash flow numbers, we're going to talk about how to value control and how to value synergy. In session 27, I'm going to talk about how to change value. We're going to switch gears and say, hey, we know how to value companies, but if you are asked to increase the value of a company, what are the levers you can use to increase value? In session 28, as I call it, it's my grand finale, where we take everything and we throw them into the heap. Now, this is too late for pre-season prep. But if you feel a little queasy about your basics, you know, your accounting basics, your statistics, and your finance basics, try one of the primers I have. My accounting primer is about 9 pages. After 9 pages, it's ran out of stuff to say. You know, basically, it's financial statement analysis more than accounting. Can you read an income statement? Do you know the difference between operating income and net income? And don't freak out and say, my God, I don't know the difference. It's not that complicated, but I want you to get comfortable reading a financial statement. So when I talk about operating income, you don't misunderstand it for net income. And in statistics, you know, we'll talk about regressions. If you don't even remember what a regression is, you know, it's probably because your statistics class did a really bad job of making it stick. Again, I have a short primer on what do regressions do, what's a correlation, what's a covariance, kind of review it, if nothing else. And finally, most of the MBAs who take my valuation class also take my corporate finance class. And I have a very different. I mean, my corporate finance classes are very applied, very different. So if any of you are interested in seeing my corporate finance class as a preview of how I think about businesses, you're welcome. The entire class is online. You can kind of take a version of it and get up to catch up with how I think about betas and risk-free rates and risk premiums. But it's not something you have to do because, as I said, we'll revisit them as part of this class as well. You're saying, what the heck is this? I have some bad news for you. Starting today, I will take over your mailbox. I will take over your life. Pretty much, I will act like you have no other classes to take this semester. And that's really the truth. This is the only class that matters. All the other stuff, you know, put to the side. And here's what will happen. Monday, you'll have a class. Right after this class, you'll get an email. Why? I could send it to you as a text, but I'm not that. My texting is terrible, so it'll be an email. Describing what we did in the class. You say, I remember. Just to remind you, just in case you've already forgotten what we did. So it'll be starting a week from tomorrow, you'll see what I call evaluation of the week. What is that? I'll pick a company to value. What company? Some company I'm interested in. It's all about me anyway. Okay. So let's say next week I decide to value Tesla again. It's time for me to revisit that valuation of Tesla since the price has gone up and I have to decide whether to continue to hold it. I'll put up my Excel spreadsheet valuation of Tesla with my story. And then I'll ask you to value Tesla. It's not graded. You don't have to do it. But as I said, remember what I said. If you really want to understand valuation, you got to get your hands dirty. You say, but it'll be the first week. I won't know enough about valuation. Change what you feel comfortable changing. I'll create a Google shared spreadsheet where I will put my numbers up and my value, and I will ask you when you got your numbers to put the value up. And I'll tell you what will happen. Next week when I do my valuation, most of your valuation will be really close to mine. Why? You will change the third decimal point on the risk-free rate because you don't feel comfortable enough disagreeing with me. You know when I know this class is working? Is when I get to week 7 or week 8 and I put up a valuation of a company. And you actually come up to me and tell me to my face, every input you estimated is wrong. And that's when I know the class is working. So each week I will pick a very different company. It'll be an emerging market, developed market, mature, oil company, commodity company, pretty much across the spectrum because I want you to get comfortable valuing different kinds of companies. On Wednesday, right after class, in the email, I will send you what's called a weekly challenge. What's a weekly challenge? I'll take the topic we've covered that week, because Monday and Wednesday are the classes, and I'll create, it's more a puzzle than a problem, where I will take what we did that week and say, can you take it one level up? Again, it's completely optional. You don't have to turn it in. I'm not going to check it off. This is, in a sense, you know, this class will be like drinking out of a hose. The water is going to come squirt. You have to decide what you have time to do. So weekly challenge is if you feel fascinated by a particular topic, you want to expand on it, so Wednesday. The solution of the weekly challenge will be posted on Sunday. So that's why you don't have to turn it in to me. You can do it and check the solution out. And it'll be a great way to keep up with the class because it'll make you think about the concepts and take them to the next level. On Thursday, you will get an update about your project. You're saying, what project? I have some bad news. I'll come to that in a minute. No? But every Thursday, I'll be telling you where you need to be on the project. Think of me as your GPS, but you're way back there. Okay? But I know you'll fall behind, but this is my nag, saying, how far behind are you? Do you feel guilty yet? Do you feel guilty yet? I'm hoping you feel guilty enough that you don't put everything off till the 15th week. On Friday, I'll do a topical webcast. Like what? Like a Kim Kardashian little, not quite like that, no. But basically, I'll pick something that you have to do, like reading a 10K. I'll start with that this week. Because we see 10Ks, they're like 250 pages. So I'll take you through the process of how I read a 10K. So it'll be a webcast on something very practical. On Friday, you'll get a newsletter. Don't expect a lot of news. Say, this is what we covered this week. And I'll tell you why I do this. As we go through the weeks, you're going to start to lose connection with where we are in the class, where are we? Because you have so much stuff happening. So the newsletter is more to orient you and say, this is where we're in the lecture notes, this is where we are, this is what's coming up, just a reminder of things to do. On Sunday, as I said, I'll post the weekly challenge solution, and then we'll start the whole process again. Last semester when I taught this class, I think I sent 112 emails over 15 weeks. And that's pretty much what you should expect to get. I think I let you off during the spring break, 7 days without. But I will harass you for the next 15 weeks. And I have absolutely no qualms about harassing you because you've paid a lot of money for this class. And I want to make sure you get value for your money, or at least I get blood extracted in return for that money. Okay? As for each class, you know, be here. I don't take attendance. It's pointless. What am I going to do? If I took attendance, that's all we do every class. Just take your attendance. Class is over. Go home. Okay? I'd like you to be here. But if you sleep in really late, it's really, really late, and you don't wake up for the class, or you feel sick. I mean, let's face it. Things happen. You might not be able to make class, you know. But if you can, try to be here. Try to be on time, but I'd rather that you come in 15 minutes late than not at all. If you want to eat pizza in the last row, I can live with a lot of distraction. Yeah? Bring your lecture note packet. That's the only thing you absolutely need. So the lecture note packets, I've sent you 2 emails already. If you haven't received an email from me, how many of you haven't received any emails from me? It's probably because, are you a non-Stern student? If you're a non-Stern student, Stern doesn't tell you this, or they should have, you get a Stern email when you take a Stern class, and everything goes to that email. I want you to find out what that email is and make sure you get that email, because later in this class, there are things you can access in the Stern databases that you need the Stern email for. And some of the Google shared spreadsheets, you need that stern.nyu.edu at the end or nyu.edu at the end to get in. So make sure if you're not getting the emails that you find out that email. So that's the only thing. If you do miss a class, one of the things I work on is to try to make myself as dispensable as possible. So I've tried to, for 30 years, figure out ways of, can I do things that will make me unnecessarier? So basically, every class here will be recorded. It'll be available as a stream, so right from the server. I will create a YouTube video of it. The advantage of YouTube is you don't need bandwidth. You can watch it on your iPhone, so when you want to exercise and they're watching Netflix, you want to watch a lecture, or whatever makes your boat go down the river. You know. I'll also create as a downloadable video file in case you're on a long flight, you want to catch. So there's no excuse for missing a lecture. So if you have to travel, that's fine. If you're sick, that's okay. You can always catch up because the lectures will go online. It'll take about 3 hours after the class ends for them to show up because that's the lead time before they let me know. But by tonight, those links should be live. There is no required book for this class. And if you do want a book, I've 5 books on valuation, each taking a different kind of look. So you can actually check out what's different about them. So there's a book on narrative and numbers. It's basically about the stories and the numbers. Yeah. You don't need any of them. As I said, you can live with the lecture notes. The investment valuation book is the only real textbook in here, which means there's problems and solutions. But those problems and solutions are also on my website. So if you, these books are all obscenely, at least the textbooks are all obscenely overpriced. I still remember right after I finished one of my books, the publisher offered to send me 20 copies. I thought he was going to send it free. So he sent the 20 copies, and then he sent me a bill. And I sent them all back, saying, I'm not paying this absurd price. Okay. He said, I gave you a 20% discount. But I said, after the 20% discount, it's still $80 a book. I'm not paying $80 for a paperback. So, the investment valuation actually is in 2 versions. This is how stupid publishers have got. There's a textbook version which sells for $80, and there's a trade version that sells for $40. They're exactly the same book. Okay? And it's perfectly legal to get the trade version. So if you find the trade version on Amazon, get it, but if you need a book. If you have an Apple device, an iPad, or an iPhone, a friend of mine at Dartmouth, Anand Sundaram, and I created an app for the phone called UValue, which basically does an intrinsic valuation of a company. So if you're the kind of person who's late for a flight and your idea of fun is to value a company, you're kind of sick, but if that's your, you can download the app, put the numbers in, but 10 minutes later you'll have a value for Apple that you can show your seatmate. Look, I valued Apple right now. Whatever makes you feel happy. Pretty much everything for this class will be on my website. You know where you're not going to find it? I'm sorry, but I don't use NYU classes. I just don't like closed systems. I never have. So everything you need for the class will be on the page that I've sent a couple of links before. So if you click on that page, you'll go into the main page for this class. Everything comes from there. There will be an iTunes U version of this class. For those of you who have never been, you download the app again. You can get it even for a non-Apple device, I think. But if you download the device, you'll see the whole class show up. You'll see the lectures. So it's an alternative to the YouTube. You know. And finally, as I said, the YouTube channel will carry all the lectures. I sent you the link to the Google Calendar for the class. It has the quizzes, quiz dates. And if you get a chance, visit my blog, because that's pretty much where I put what I'm doing right now. Like I just posted this morning on looking back at the last decade, what things look like in markets, what stocks did, what bonds did, you know, basically a review of a decade. And I have a Twitter feed, which you can follow or not follow. Frankly, I don't care. I wanted to get up to 100,000. I'm not to 120. I'm not Kanye West. That guy has 42 million followers. I don't know what he does. I don't think he tweets about discounted cash flow valuations. Maybe that's my problem. No. But I'm trying to get up to 1 million, so if you have multiple email addresses, follow me, then block me. I really don't care. I'm looking for numbers then. I'm almost there. Right? How will this class get graded? I'll tell you what I'm looking for. If you can value just about anything, I'm going to try to figure out a way to give you an A or an A minus. So my job is to figure out whether you really can value. So my quizzes, my exams, my projects. If you can value most things, B plus to a B, so somewhere in that spectrum. If you can value something, that's not asking for much. See, if you still can value nothing, then I'm looking for D's and F's. So everything in this class is designed for me to make that separation. So there will be a project, which we will talk about at the start of the next class. There'll be three quizzes, each worth 10% apiece, and a final exam, which is 30%. So it's to be announced. I think the date is now being put up on the NYU calendar. It's Friday from, I'll send it, it's like 3 to 4:45. No, I'll send you the exact times. It's Friday the 15th. No. So at least it's before the weekend, so you can be done and move on. If you're interested, read this page very carefully about quizzes, because with three quizzes, each worth 10%, some of you might have to miss a quiz, maybe even two. This tells you what happens. What will happen is if you miss a quiz, the 10% on that quiz will always get moved forward into the remaining quiz. You know why? Because otherwise you'll get strategic quiz missing, which is you do really well in the first two, you'll strategically miss the third quiz to make your first. I wasn't born yesterday, so I've kind of had to figure out ways to make sure that I can push back when you do the strategic game playing. So quizzes will all get moved up. If you take all three quizzes, the bonus you get is I will take your lowest score quiz and mark up that score to the average score on the rest of your quizzes. So let's say you get 10, 0, 10, 30. Two perfect quizzes, perfect final, and one quiz you completely blew up. Make it a 2, not a 0. I will take the 2 and replace it with a 10 because you got 100% on your remaining quizzes. So think about everything other than that bad quiz. I'll take that percentage score, attach it. So that's a little bonus you get if you take all three quizzes. But as I said, if you miss a quiz, it's not the end of the world. I'll just move the quiz score to the remaining quizzes. And you cannot use laptops on the quiz, but you can bring in your iPads because many of you will have, or tablets because many of you will have your notes on it, but you cannot use Excel or any spreadsheets on your iPad. You can use it as a calculator, but that's about it. So calculators, iPads for notes, open book, open notes. Okay. So I'll talk about the project next session when we start.